Thank you, Rabbi Walter. I thank my friends, Rabbi Walter and President Hochstadt, for inviting me, giving me the privilege to speak before you this evening. As Rabbi Walter mentioned, just to expand slightly on my resume, simply so that you have the perspective to understand when I make statements about what Beis Din does or doesn't do, just so you understand what I know and what I don't know. I've been learning in Beis Medrash Gavoa in Lakewood, New Jersey for the last, until I moved to Camille about 6 months ago, for the previous 15 years or so. Most of that time, that was the highest level of learning I attained, was studying Chashon Mishpat and Evan Ezer, which essentially is Jewish civil law and family law, which is a sort of branch of civil law, but we treat it somewhat separately. And for a number of those years, I participated actually in several Batei Din in Lakewood. Batei Din in Lakewood are perhaps different than Batei Din elsewhere. We'll touch as we go on some of the differences. So my experience, my personal direct experience is with various organizations in Lakewood. I have observed, audited various Batei Din elsewhere in the US, in Israel. And that's my particular perspective. The title of this evening's lecture, the one we finally settled on, was Beis Din Demystified, a comparison and contrast of the modern Beis Din system with its secular counterpart. This was actually the third or fourth attempt. My initial one was all about civil procedure, which was promptly vetoed by Noah on the grounds that any lawyer who hears the word civil procedure, his eyes will glaze over, he'll go to sleep or run the other way. The counter proposal, the counter offer was the mysteries of Beis Din revealed, or something like that. And I promptly vetoed that one. We are not the National Enquirer or a breathless teen magazine. So then this is a compromise, Beis Din Demystified, where the goal is gonna be to explain what Beis Din is, what its procedures are, how it is similar to secular court, how it is different from secular courts. Hopefully, we'll just come away at the end of this evening with a better understanding. Everyone can have his own opinion on what Beis Din is and whether they like it or not, but any opinion, certainly, I think we can all agree, ought to be based on a good understanding of what we're dealing with. So that's what I'm going to attempt to do tonight. Third aspect of the title is I noted the modern Beis Din system. And this is really important because over the millennia in which Beis Din has been in existence, first, Beis Din has evolved. The role of Beis Din in Talmudic times, in the times of the Gaonim, 1,000 years ago, in the times of the medieval period, the time of the Rishonim, the pre-Enlightenment period of the Achronim, half a millennium ago, the post-Enlightenment Batei Din, till today's Batei Din in America, the United States, in Israel, other countries that have Jewish populations, the role of Beis Din has changed in many ways. Moreover, when we talk about what Beis Din is and how Beis Din works, we have to distinguish between, as in any area, between the theoretical, what the books say, how Beis Din is described academically, and the practical, how Beis Din actually works on the ground. Related point, we have to discuss the ideal versus the actual. Even if we all agree Beis Din should work a certain way, Beis Din human beings are imperfect, Beis Din may not always work exactly the way it should. And lastly, there are variations in Batei Din. The system, certainly in the US, system is something of a misnomer. Every Beis Din sets its own rules, its own policies. The Dayanim impose their own character, their own personalities, their own value system, somewhat on the Beis Din. So whatever we say about Beis Din has to be understood that there will be significant variation between different countries, certainly within a country, between different communities. The Beis Din of America is a very different organization than Machon Lahara, a Hasidish organization of Muncie. They're both highly esteemed organizations, but they're very different organizations. So again, my perspective, the Batei Din in which I have the most experience are various operations out of Lakewood, which are probably characterized, A, we are mostly specialists. Most of us, most of us are Chashon Mishpat focused. We tend to be academic, book oriented. Most of us are not out in the world, don't have a great deal of experience. We tend to do things by the book. We believe in making things accessible, so we try to lower the barriers to entry. We take petty cases. We routinely do matters of $100, a couple of $100. We do charge fees. We'll discuss fees more later. Our fees are lower, and we try to make things more accessible. Other Batei Din may have much higher fees, may be more difficult to schedule. They may be more geared toward higher profile, higher stakes operations. And again, as we go, we'll touch on, we'll discuss various differences in how Batei Din work between the various operations of which I am aware today. Now, what exactly is a Beis Din? So anyone who's taken grade school civics is familiar with the tripartite division of modern democratic government into an executive branch, a legislative branch, and a judicial branch. Basin is most oftenly translated as a court, a rabbinic court. And this is true, certainly today, and even historically, the Basin's job is largely what we think of as the judicial branch. However, certainly in Talmudic times and biblical times, the modern Western democratic notion of separation of church and state does not exist historically. While there were perhaps different branches of government, there was certainly a tremendous mixture of the secular, the religious, and it would have made no sense. It would have been completely alien to the mindset of our predecessors a couple of millennia ago to the idea of render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and render unto God what is God's is not really something that would have figured into the Jewish political structure. The Batei Din, in the time of Chazal, in the time of the Talmud, the time of the Temple, even later generations, Batei Din fulfilled a mixture, they filled a mixture of roles that were both, that we would call certainly the judicial, also the legislative, also the executive. And there was a mixture of what we would consider secular and what we would consider purely religious. So while they certainly tried cases, and that may have been the bulk of their work, they certainly legislated also. We have, certainly in Talmudic times, we have references to the Basin of so-and-so who promulgated this edict, or the Basin of so-and-so who took that step. So Batei Din certainly enacted legislation as well as adjudicated cases. And the executive function was also to a large extent under their jurisdiction too. The Basin had Shotrim. We read in Dvarim, the Parsha says, Shoftim v'Shotrim. You should have Shoftim and Shotrim. The commentators have typically explained that Shoftim are judges and Shotrim are enforcers. But that was, to an extent, under the executive branch's jurisdiction. They carried out, they enforced their own sentences, they enforced the law. Now, there was, of course, a monarchy. There was, of course, an authority structure independent of Beis Din. In biblical times, we had a monarchy, we had a hereditary monarchy, there were kings. In later times, there were other forms of government. But it's not so simple. Today, we think of the monarchy or the presidency as the executive. But again, what exactly the kings did in biblical times is not entirely clear. There is a famous idea, it's a controversial idea, and it's far from clear whether this is considered the consensus or an outlier, but there is a famous idea in an essay of the Ran, the Drashas HaRan. He makes the point that classic Choshen Mishpat, Jewish civil law, which today is one of the four Chalakim of Shulchan Aruch, is not really sufficient to well-regulate a society. I was actually discussing this with Noah a week or two ago. I pointed out to him that criminal law in Judaism is pretty limited. We do have capital punishment for a couple of dozen crimes, murder, certain types of forbidden unions, Shabbos, Avodah Zarah. That's pretty much it. And the bar, the procedural bar, what we would call Fifth Amendment type stuff for imposing the death penalty or even any corporal punishment really, the only other one besides death is lashes, beating essentially. There's no notion of jail in the formal criminal justice system. It's either death, lashes, or nothing, or sometimes financial fines, but they're typically low. And the bar, the procedural bar for imposing a death penalty sentence or even lashes is quite high. We have to have proper testimony of two qualified witnesses. They have to have properly warned the perpetrator of his fate. He has to have acknowledged receiving the warning. Basically, most criminals would not be punished, certainly not be executed. And Noah was quite surprised. This is hardly an effective deterrent. Theft, essentially, if they catch you, you make restitution. That's pretty much it. There's no jail. Sometimes you pay kefil, you pay a fine of 100% above the money you stole, but even that's in fairly limited circumstances, and there's really not much in the sense of disincentive for criminals. So the Ran has this idea that the Torah expects the monarch to legislate, to pass additional regulations that are necessary for the well-regulation of society. He says the Torah's laws in Mishpatim that we learn in Shulchan Aruch are the eternal, timeless, ultimately fair laws, but they aren't necessarily very effective in regulating active human societies, and it's the government's job to institute more laws. We haven't had really a Jewish government until the State of Israel for quite a while. The State of Israel doesn't always ask Shiloh, so it's difficult to know how the government actually ran back in Talmudic times, but the idea certainly is recognized that Choshen Mishpat may not be sufficient to regulate society properly. So as I said, in the time of Chazal, Beis Din, in addition to its legislative and judicial executive function, did have a core judicial function. It was actually a hierarchy of Batei Din. There was the famous Sanhedrin, the highest level court, which had the unique ability to hear, to try certain types of cases involving Kohen Gadol and the Melech, possibly even a declaration of war. The Gemara, the Halacha seems to be the Sanhedrin have to sign off on it. That's a function we typically attribute today to either the Congress, in American democracy at least, Congress declares war, the president prosecutes war. In those days, the Sanhedrin was involved too. As I said, it had a kind of general political function too, but the most famous aspect of their work certainly was the trying of cases. And in those days, they had two basic roles, what we would consider criminal justice, the punishment of criminals, the sentencing, trying, sentencing, and punishing of criminals, and what we consider civil cases, adjudicating financial disputes, marital disputes between two parties. People occasionally ask me, I'm never sure if they're serious or not, does Beis Din still do criminal justice? The answer is no. Both as a formal matter, the Gemara says at a certain point close to the Churban, Beis Din ceased its function of criminal justice. They no longer executed people and they no longer punished people, even with lashes. And certainly today in America, Beis Din does not engage in criminal justice. Now, we do find throughout history that Batei Din did, the community's lay leadership as well as Batei Din, did enact various sorts of regulations that were necessary for communal order. We find communities in Ashkenazic cultures and the Sephardic cultures for thousands of years until pretty much the Enlightenment, where the government actively destroyed the quasi-autonomy that the Jews had known for centuries, millennia, and integrated the Jews as ordinary citizens subject to the laws of the land. We do find that Batei Din were integrally involved in the running of the communities. But for most of our presentation tonight, we will focus primarily on Beis Din's role as a judicial body. Now, Beis Din has a certain view from the perspective of secular law. Again, before the Enlightenment and in earlier generations of Klal Yisrael, Beis Din operated with government sanction. The government delegated various forms of government to religious communities, in particular the Jews. So the Beis Din then was pretty much a recognized governmental entity. Certainly after the Enlightenment, from certainly the mid-19th century, Batei Din have typically not had special legal status. What Beis Din looks like in the eyes of the law, and this was true already, we have records of this back in European countries in the mid-19th century, Beis Din is an arbitration panel. Now, arbitration is an interesting bird. I certainly didn't fully understand what it meant, how broad its powers are until I got involved in Batei Din. Arbitration is one particular form of what the legal people call ADR, alternative dispute resolution, mediation, negotiation, other forms. But people are often surprised to hear that state governments, typically arbitration is a state matter, governments give arbitrators enormous latitude to do whatever they want, or more correctly, whatever the disputants, whatever powers they wish to award the arbitration organization, the arbitrators in their specific case. While there are nationally recognized arbitration organizations, the law doesn't particularly care. The law does not care if the arbitrator has any certification. Your hairdresser may have to have some license, but an arbitrator does not. As long as the disputants accept a given arbitrator, or a given organization, a given panel, that's it. His decisions are binding upon the disputants. The court does not want to second guess them. The court does not want to know how they arrived at their conclusions. The court generally does not want to know what system they used, if they had any system. The only things the court would really care about in general is whether certain basic standards of procedural fairness were followed. For example, if there's an undisclosed conflict of interest, that could be grounds for the court tossing out the decision. If the court failed to allow one party time or the ability to present his case properly, that would be considered a fundamental procedural fairness violation. And that might be grounds for overturning it. But other than that, whether you decide based on halacha, sharia, intuitive sense of right and wrong, some standardized national or international body of rules, the court doesn't want to know. And again, generalizing anything for what the court does or doesn't do is a minefield. There'll always be a court who'll be a little more aggressive, and there have been a few cases in recent years where courts did take pretty aggressive steps in overturning arbitration agreements of Batei Din on the grounds that they didn't really like the decision. They didn't think it was particularly fair. But in general, I'm not a lawyer, but in general, my understanding is the courts are very reluctant to oversee, to second guess the decision made by arbitrators, and it generally will stand as long as you're careful to follow basic standards of procedural fairness. Now, from a halachic perspective, that's also true. to a large extent, from a halakhic perspective too, based in functions somewhat as arbitrators. Now, even though Me'ikra Din, according to technical halakha, a Beis Din decides the law, according to halakha, a Beis Din follows Chashon Mishpat, follows the laws of Mishpatim and of Torah Shebaal Peh, and hands down rulings, there is something called Pshara. Pshara, Hebrew word for compromise, and there's an entire discussion of it in the Gemara, in the Tractate of Sanhedrin, where there are all kinds of different opinions and different statements, but the consensus of the Gemara, the consensus of the later poskim, is very clear that litigants, disputants, are encouraged to reach settlements, reach agreements. Beis Din is encouraged generally to encourage the disputants to reach a settlement. And pshara is a good idea. Disputants, litigants often do not want to hear about pshara. They're angry, they're upset, they think it's unfair, they think the other party is taking advantage. And I understand all those feelings. And I'm not claiming that every disputant should run to pshara. I'm not saying every disputant should always be accepting pshara and pushing for it. But it's important to understand that the Torah does generally consider pshara a good idea. Now, when disputants appear before a Beis Din, the Gemara says the Beis Din is supposed to ask the disputants, do you want din or do you want pshara? The litigants have the right to say, we want din. And Beis Din then will limit itself ideally to din. Or Beis Din is supposed to encourage the disputants to authorize them to compose a pshara, which will then be binding upon them. So pshara essentially has a few forms. Ideally, two people who have a dispute can negotiate between themselves privately without ever appearing before Beis Din, resolve their issue, make a kinyan, shake hands, draw up a contract, and settle the matter without ever coming to Beis Din. That's fine. We encourage that. We're not making a living off this. Many of us, at least, I certainly have never was in Lakewood. We took de minimis fees. More about that later. But you can work it out among yourselves. Great. Often, disputants' passions involved or their limited negotiating skills or for other numerous other reasons will have trouble reaching an agreement. So what the ADR community, the next thing is called mediation. You can bring in someone who can simply act as a facilitator. It can be a Beis Din, it can be a rabbi, it can be a friend, it can be a respected party, someone respected by both parties, a lawyer, someone skilled in negotiation, in mediation. His job essentially is to referee. He has no power to impose anything. All he can do is simply act as a catalyst for the two parties to reach some kind of agreement. Again, halakha is fine with that. As long as the two parties reach some agreement, facilitated by a mediator, not facilitated by a mediator, under Torah principles, under any principles of equity, under any rules they can come up with among themselves, that's all fine, that's great, that's called pshara. Once again, we encourage that. If that doesn't work, parties will often end up in Beis Din. So Beis Din plays a dual role. In the modern Beis Din system, Beis Din plays a dual role. They are both arbitrators. They are people with the power to impose a settlement upon the disputants. They are also, however, mediators. They also will typically attempt to try to facilitate a compromise between the two parties themselves. That's always advantageous, because if they can reach a conclusion on their own, there's more of a likelihood they'll accept it. Hopefully the feelings, the passions will cool a little bit. So a typical Beis Din, the way it's practiced today, will go back and forth. When they'll hear the case in a formal proceeding, they'll hear both sides present their case. If the Dayanim think there's room for compromise, if they think either party is tractable, can be reasonable, if they think there's room for a pshara, they will attempt to facilitate one. They'll make suggestions. They'll attempt to find out what both parties really need, what the minimum is they can accept, and they will attempt to act as catalysts for reaching some kind of pshara. Back when I was in Lakewood, I took a seminar along with some of my colleagues, an 18-hour mediation course done by a fellow, a Jewish fellow who had served in the New Jersey, I don't know what it's called, the department, the Bureau of Mediation. He did a lot of consumer affairs. He was the head of some division there. And he was a fellow who had taught mediation and arbitration on a law school level. He had given a handful of the various New Jersey schools. So it was quite an interesting seminar. The techniques we were learning don't come that naturally to me, the negotiation parts, the mediation parts. So there was a lot of role-playing. He said that was considered best practices in the industry. It was required, or at least recommended, that he doesn't just sit there and lecture at us, but that he had all these scenarios devised where we would team up and break up into teams or individuals and practice mediation and again, negotiation. Yaakov Dambrov was his name. One particular exercise just, I'll never forget. I think these were his own. He were adapted from books, but he had a good flair for it. So in one exercise, there were two teams who were negotiating over who was going to buy a limited crop of a fictitious vegetable called a Vegemot, V-E-G-I-M-O-T. And each side had, you know, information that the other side wasn't privy to. One side was told they needed that they needed the seeds of the plant to produce some kind of some vaccine for a pending terrorist attack. The other side was told that the rinds of the fruit were crucial to producing some kind of cure for cancer or something. And, you know, each side was told how much he should offer and what he needed, and there was a very limited trap, and the two sides were dumped into an arena to duke it out. So, you know, we all sat there in our 10 teams or so, and we all came up with various solutions, whether we could, one side would give in, one side would outbid the other side. There was only one of us, I remember, who actually got the right answer. He was like, wait a second, you need seeds, and you need rinds. Great, split the crap, you take all the rinds, I get all the seeds, wonderful. And the lesson, of course, is that part of making a compromise is not always a zero-sum game. Sometimes, you know, what one party needs or another party needs are not completely incompatible. And if you listen to both parties and if you listen carefully to what they really need, what they really want, it will be a lot easier to work out a compromise. One actual case I once had, there was a case of a successful businessman, American, did things by the book. He had hired some high school kid who was half-baked, didn't show up on time, kind of undisciplined. And then he sued him he wanted to withhold his whole salary. It was a summer job or something from a high school kid. He wanted to withhold his salary and just throw the book at him. And he's probably right. I mean, the guy had significantly failed to fulfill his job duties. At the end of the day, we were able to convince them to work something out because the money wasn't that important to the guy. He wanted the kid to be taught a lesson. He wanted the kid to be taught you can't take a job and then show up when you want and do what you want and expect to get paid. For the kid, it was, you know, he admitted he was wrong and he just didn't feel that he had put in a whole summer of work. He didn't want to be deprived of all the salary. So basically, you know, he can work out in such a case. And it wasn't that each side needed the money to put food on his table. So I don't remember exactly what we worked out, but basically, the kid would be sanctioned enough that he would be formally taught a lesson, and the other guy would be vindicated that his employee had misbehaved. The kid would get something. So in that case, it wasn't a zero sum game, and then that's important always in formulating psharas. Now, negotiated psharas are fine. The Beis Din can also, though, impose a pshara. Beis Din can actually tell the litigants, okay, here's what we've decided, and it may not be based on strict din, it may simply be our judgment, essentially, of equity of what we're deciding for you. Now, why would Beis Din do that? So why would they not stick to the din if they're, you know, if they're competent, if they're qualified? Shouldn't they know the din? And if they do, why shouldn't they simply impose the din? So there are a number of reasons the Gemara, the post, can give for imposing pshara and not din. One of them is indeed humility. Even though we learn Torah and we study and we learn from other batei din, but at the end of the day, Chasam Mishpat is long and it's complicated, and we shouldn't all consider ourselves great experts. And it behooves us to remember that we don't know everything, and therefore we may be wrong. And that is one reason for working something out. Additionally, not everything is black and white. Sometimes you can make halakhic arguments and counter them and counter the counters. You can go back and forth and you will ultimately reach some conclusion, or the conclusion may just be that it's a question of doubt and the possessor will win. The rule of muksuk, that whoever has the money wins. But it's not as if the halakha is clear cut that way. There are good arguments on both sides. So the idea of pshara is that we acknowledge that and we say that even if, you know, by a knife's edge you're right, the other side's claim has a fair amount of merit too. And we should respect that too. Another reason, halacha has a whole tier of levels of obligation. There's your basic level of chiyuv, something you must do, something which is enforceable by Beis Din. But just as in other areas of halacha, there's an idea of midas chasidus, lefnim ishuris hadin, different levels of obligation which are not strictly mandatory but are encouraged. You know, a person who is a God-fearing person should do certain things. So in Chasam Mishpat too, there are many areas where strict halacha is one way, but a person is encouraged to do more. So Beis Din formulating a pshara may not let somebody get away with something, even if he technically has a loophole for it. If Beis Din feels it's the wrong thing to do, so that they may not completely rule in favor of that, rule that he must do the thing which halacha doesn't say he has to, but they may impose a pshara based on that. He should pay at least something, or he should concede something, because after all, he's not really doing the right thing. Now, Beis Din's right to make a pshara for any of these reasons, and the fourth reason is simply shalom. There is a major value all over the Talmud, all over Judaism, of shalom, of preserving peace. Sometimes Beis Din will feel that one party may win, but that'll cause lasting enmity, and if they work something out, again, that's Beis Din's judgment. Sometimes taking money away from somebody who doesn't deserve to it can make things worse, and Beis Din has to make that judgment and be responsible about it. But pshara, the Gemara says, does have the power to enhance shalom, And Basin takes that into account in deciding whether to issue a pshara. Now, Basin's right to make a pshara actually depends. Normally, if one is summoned to Beis Din, one comes to Beis Din, more about the summoning process soon, Beis Din does not necessarily have any right to impose a pshara. Even then, in certain cases, the poskim do award Beis Din that right, in limited cases. But today, in contemporary Batei Din, the right, the ability of a Beis Din to impose a pshara is largely based on the next thing I want to talk about, which is the Shtari Beirin, the arbitration agreement. As we've mentioned, Beis Din acts as an arbitration tribunal. So, as far as I know, most Batei Din, before they will hear your case, ask you to sign documents. In our Beis Din, in Lakewood, we would typically have two versions. We would have a Hebrew one drawn up reflecting halakha considerations. We would have an English one designed for us by lawyers, an arbitration agreement based on the laws of New Jersey or New York. And the parties to the dispute accept the authority of the Beis Din as arbitrators for their case. Now, even from a halakhic perspective, we do that too. And typically, the Shtar Berurin, the agreement they sign, grants the Beis Din various waivers over numerous halachas, numerous limitations on what Beis Din can do. It grants the Beis Din considerably expanded powers. One area is what we've just been discussing. An agreement will typically say that Beis Din has the right to impose a pshara if they think that's appropriate due to the various considerations we've been discussing and not limit themselves to strict din. Some of the things they say are fairly technical, things that most people probably wouldn't realize are issues in the first place. For example, a Beis Din is not supposed to rule at night. We typically do. There is actually an opinion, a famous opinion of the Sma, who says that the reason Beis Din shouldn't operate at night is because it's dark and it's hard to see the litigants, it's hard to read their faces. And the Sma actually therefore says that if you have good lighting, it's fine. And that is an opinion noted by the poskim, although it's a minority opinion. But according to many poskim, you should not operate at night. And it is common for an agreement to say the litigants grant the dayanim the right to operate at night. And there are numerous other technical, procedural flexibilities which the Beis Din would like to arrogate to itself in the document. There are cases where, for example, if one of the dayanim becomes incapacitated or is unable to serve for some reason, so the Beis Din will say that we have the right to continue with the remaining two, and so on and so forth. So the Shtar Berurin typically grants the Beis Din various, mostly procedural flexibilities, which otherwise they might not have. So in terms of the basic qualifications for dayanim, so as we mentioned, you shouldn't be doing it at night, but we typically waive that. In terms of the level of education, expertise, certification, there really isn't much that's standardized. In Talmudic times, there was something called smicha. There was the formal smicha that was passed down from master to student. That was lost, we don't know exactly when, but sometime during the Roman persecutions, apparently, in the Talmudic period. Today, we don't have real smicha. There was a famous attempt in the 16th century to reintroduce it. They tried for a while, but it ultimately failed. And today, we don't have real smicha. We do, of course, have a pseudo-smicha. There are various forms of it. There's yara yara, yadin yadin. Rabbis typically get some form of smicha. That was basically an institution of the late Ashkenazic Rishon, the late medieval period. It was meant, apparently, historically, to be a kind of systematization of the rabbinate. The leaders of the communities felt that anyone was calling himself rabbi, hanging out a shingle, things were getting out of control. So they attempted to impose some kind of uniformity, some kind of standardized credentials for having rabbis. I once read that the Sfardim actually were very skeptical of that. They felt that the Ashkenazim were aping the university system where doctorates and titles were important. They felt it was just a foreign import to Judaism. Whatever it is, it's become pretty standard today. Most practicing rabbis in almost any capacity will have some formal certification. That's really not relevant to a Beis Din. Certainly not from a legal perspective, not really from a halachic perspective either. Ideally, you want the dayan really to know what he's doing, but there's no formal rigid qualification he has to have. In Israel, the system is somewhat more standardized. The Rabbanut system of Batei Din, they have exams, they have a much more westernized formal system of certification. But in the U.S., it's pretty much word of mouth, reputation. There aren't really any formal qualifications that a dayan has to have. I actually served, when I was in Lakewood, I served for a number of years when I was not yet married. I was unique on our base and unique on most organizations that I knew, and there were people actually who complained about it. But again, that's not really a halacha. That's kind of a communal policy thing. Some communities didn't want single people sitting on the base. And again, not actually a strict requirement. the summoning process, what we call sending out a hazmana. Beis Din sends out a hazmana, literally an invitation, more like a demand, typically a written demand for a disputant to appear before Beis Din. Typically, one party contacts the Beis Din and says, I have a dispute with so-and-so, please issue him a hazmana. He submits contact information, Beis Din sends it out. Now, you can also have a consensual din Torah. If both parties are cooperating and if it's a relatively amicable case, you can save time, money, effort by simply scheduling a din Torah together. And that happens, you know, not infrequently, but in a contested din Torah, you frequently have to go through the hazmana route where one party is summoned by the other to appear before a Beis Din. Now, one area related to the hazmana where Batei Din, at least according to some opinions, work on a very, very different pattern than secular court, has to do with the notion of discovery. In the secular system, certainly after a litigation has commenced, at some point or another, my wife has explained to me exactly when, at some point or another, parties have to turn over relevant information to each other, they have to show what evidence they have, documents. Halacha really doesn't have any such notion. As a matter of fact, there's a major dispute among the Achronim whether you even have to plead your case, that's what I've told me it's called, before the court, before you actually start the trial. According to one opinion, you can say, Reuven can call the Beis Din, say, I would like a hazmana against Shimon, matter unspecified, to be discussed when we're here together in Beis Din. Other party can say, well, tell me what it is. Nope, I'll see you in court, that's it. This is a major position of many Achronim. Others disagree, they say you can't do that. But even that, the main reason they give is not because it's somehow fair for him to have advanced discovery of the other side's material. They simply say because maybe he'll agree, maybe he'll concede the case and save himself the trouble of a court case. Maybe he'll settle, he'll simply concede. But other than that, the post can take as a very serious possibility that you don't even have to explain your case, let alone provide any sort of discovery. Now, as I mentioned earlier, today do deviate in many ways from what halacha strictly requires. We ask the litigants to grant us more procedural flexibility. And the truth is, if it were up to me, this is probably the number one suggestion that I've advocated for improving the system as a simple procedural question, is simply to institute more discovery. Again, halacha may not allow it strictly, but the parties can certainly waive their rights. And certainly, for example, Beis Din has the right to tell the plaintiff, if you want us to take your case and begin issuing a summons, we want you to sign that you're going to participate in discovery, and hopefully the defendant will too. But the strict halacha, it is unclear as to whether the Beis Din has the right to compel discovery from either party. I don't know if there's a standardized practice. Our organizations typically do not require any kind of systematic discovery, although occasionally if we knew enough about what the case was, we would typically ask them to provide some material simply as a convenience, but we had no formal requirements of real discovery. Now, the hazmana process, there is typically a fee. The fee structure can vary from Beis Din to Beis Din. This is an area where there is a wide divergence among different organizations. Typically, the hazmana, there is a fee for it. It can be a nominal fee, it can be more expensive, but typically, if you want a file to be opened, if you want a hazmana, the Beis Din charges some fee. I believe in my organization it was something on the order of $90, although I think we changed it various times over our fee structure was altered. I don't have the exact numbers. Once the defendant receives a hazmana, so he has the option, we get now to the question of venue selection. He certainly does not have to go to the Beis Din that the plaintiff picked, simply because the plaintiff picked that Beis Din. Plaintiff does not have the right to demand a certain Beis Din. Defendant has the right to say, I would rather go to a different Beis Din. In a city that has multiple Batei Din, they each have the right to propose their own Beis Din in the city. Either they can eventually agree on one, or they can't. Or sometimes, so if they can't, there is a procedure called Zavla, that's an Aramaic acronym for Ze Bor Lo Echad, which means each party chooses one arbitrator, one dayan, and those two arbitrators, or the two parties themselves, or in combination, choose a third neutral arbitrator. This is a whole separate topic, how the Zavla system works, whether it works, how it's abused. That's particularly problematic and sensitive topic. We don't have time for all that now, but those are the two modes of Beis Din that operate today. There is what we call Beis Din Kavua, a standardized standing Beis Din, and Zavla, which is a kind of ad hoc tribunal, which typically comes up when the parties cannot agree on the Beis Din. Now, there are all kinds of complicated rules governing venue selection. If a party wants to go to a Beis Din outside the city, does he have the right to do that? What if he feels that the local Batei Din are all interested parties? So the rules are very complicated. much of the procedural jockeying pre-trial, pre-litigation in Bate Din revolves around venue selection, especially when there's counsel involved. They spend a lot of time trying to pick an appropriate venue. But that's the next step, either accepting the summons of the original Bate Din or settling on some other organization. So eventually, the two parties will agree, hopefully, on a Bate Din. The Bate Din has to schedule a time, and like any other bureaucratic affair, there can be a lot of shuttling back and forth, emails, phone. You have to have times where all three dayanim can make it, where both litigants can make it, litigants' counsel can make it if they're bringing counsel, where various witnesses can make it. Then that can cause lots of foot dragging and lots of delays. I've mentioned counsel a couple of times. Halacha doesn't have much to say about counsel. There is an idea of a harsha, where a person, which is really more like a power of attorney, where you can appoint somebody or actually delegate some of your rights to another party. We often do that. If we fail in our base, and if we fail that somebody who's actually appearing before us does not actually have standing under halacha, we will often require them to execute a harsha that he's basically authorized by the person who does have standing to represent him, and that he will be bound by any decision handed down by the Bate Din based on the prosecution of the case by his counsel, by his mursha, we call it, by the person he's given power of attorney to. But in terms of counsel, there are really no rules. There's very little in halacha about it. People who bring counsel in Bate Din typically do one, there are three things that they do. Sometimes they simply, if they feel that they're not too articulate, or if they feel they're too easily intimidated, sometimes if it's a woman in front of three rabbis, she might feel a little uncomfortable. So often, for whatever reason, they'll simply bring someone else who they feel will be more comfortable, more aggressive, more persuasive, a friend, a relative. Sometimes somebody will bring their lawyer, either because the lawyer is intimately familiar with the case, or because the lawyer is good at litigating, or because lawyers just have an aura of specialness about them. But for whatever reason, certainly not because the lawyer is a cheap and efficient way of doing it, but for whatever reason, people will bring a lawyer occasionally, and that's fine. We allow lawyers. We have no problem with lawyers. The one problem we do have with lawyers is that lawyers, to a carpenter, everything is a nail. To a lawyer, everything is expected to follow rules of litigation. Professor Dombroff, when he taught us mediation, frequently expressed great frustration with this, how he'd have to lecture lawyers. He said, look, you're an expert in law. I know nothing about law. I wouldn't dream of contesting anything you said about law. Arbitration is not law. A lawyer will say, I object. You don't object. I make the rules. I'm the arbitrator. You don't make motions. I tell you what to do. I set the rules here. All your legal training is not relevant in where I have jurisdiction. And we sometimes have a hard time explaining this to lawyers, that things they expect, and they expect us to follow certain rules, because that's what courts do. We are under no legal, ethical, halachic obligation to follow the rules of the court. Of course, as I mentioned earlier, we do have both a moral and a legal obligation to follow basic standards of fairness. So a lawyer could certainly object if he thought we weren't giving his client enough time, or if he thought we were suppressing him or being tendentious or anything like that. That they certainly can do. But that's based more on basic notions of fairness, and a lawyer may or may not be the best one to make that judgment, but a lawyer can certainly help simply because his personality and his training gives him some experience in litigating. The third type of counsel people bring is what we call a Toein Rabbani, a rabbinic pleader. He's essentially a lawyer, but someone whose skill set is in Bate Din. His training is in Torah and experience is in Bate Din rather than legal training. The good ones, at least, are fairly expensive. They rival at least mid-range lawyers. And they can do some good, and they can also do some stuff which is not so good. They can obstruct, they can do some things that lawyers do also, I guess, like any other profession. Some of what they do is good, and some of what they do is less good. But they're a common feature, especially in high-stakes, bitter, contested Dine Torah. They are a common feature. Again, the case has to be fairly high stakes, because they'll typically charge retainers of $1,000 or $2,000, several hundred dollars an hour. So you're not going to do that for a $500 fender bender, but on more bitter, high value cases, they are often a feature. One area where halacha is very different from law, but this is really halacha, technically, we typically don't follow this that carefully, we deliberately don't follow it, not by accident, is the question of testimony. One of the things that has most struck me is how the rules of testimony, the very nature of testimony, is completely different under secular law and under halacha. Under secular law, anybody testifies, the litigants themselves, their friends, their relatives, interested parties, disinterested parties, firsthand witnesses. There's, of course, the hearsay rules, which have close analogs in halacha. Aid mi pi aid is a problem. Mi pi envelope pi ksavim. You can't have written testimony in certain cases. You can't have hearsay. But aside from that, the law typically allows pretty much anyone to testify. Halacha has all kinds of rules. Who's kosher for an aid? Relatives are not kosher. Interested parties are not kosher. This is not a credibility thing. These are essentially peremptory dismissals, peremptory blocks. If you're an interested party, you simply can't testify. We don't listen. If you're a relative, no matter how credible we think your testimony might be, we simply dismiss it and discount it. On the other hand, the law, after it hears testimony, will then be up to the judge or the jury to make an assessment of credibility. Halacha classically works just the opposite. Halacha assigns predetermined values to various forms of testimonies. Two edim, two qualified witnesses, is the gold standard. That's basically the highest level of testimony, a point which is not really accepted in modern legal theory, but one aid is a lesser level of credibility. There are various kinds of other principles, rov, chazaka, migu, but all these things have pretty well-defined rules. The judge is not making, the arbitrators are not making individual case-by-case credibility decisions. Incidentally, that's another difference. In law, you have sometimes judge, sometimes jury, different kinds of cases. Halacha has no notion of a jury. All cases are decided by the arbitrators themselves. They make decisions, dayanim, arbitrators, pashranim, people who make pshara. There is no notion of a jury of one's peers, not for criminal cases, not for civil cases. So as I said, this is the old classic halacha. People often ask me, is it really true that you won't accept the guy's brother as an aide? Practically speaking, this is another one of the things that we typically ask the litigants to waive or to give us additional flexibility. We typically write in our initial agreements that the disputants are granting the beis din the right to make findings of fact based on their assessment of any information presented to them, even if it deviates and is not in accordance with the classic halachic rules. So practically speaking, people ask me, can I bring my brother? Can I bring a written document if it's not a shtar? The answer is yes, you bring everything. You bring everything that is of any possible relevance. Beis din will sort out, both according to the rules of Eidos, as well as according to their additional powers to make findings of credibility. Beis din will decide how much they want to weigh things, but yes, they will weigh even those things. Typically, in my experience, they will weigh even those things which have no formal value as evidence according to the classic rules of the halacha. Expertise. One of the questions people often have raised about Beis din is how are you qualified to decide, you know, your rabbis, you're trained in yeshiva, what do you know about real estate? What do you know about partnership agreements? What do you know about stripping insulation off a house? And the answer, of course, is that we know nothing about this in general, and we have no need to know nothing about this. My wife, this demure young lady here who looks as though butter wouldn't melt in her mouth, before she moved to Silver Spring, was a hard-charging litigator at a big law firm in Manhattan. Did a lot of pharmaceutical work. One of her duties she used to tell me about was finding experts. I said, oh, you mean you call up a doctor and you say, I need you to testify this. Can you do this? She looks at me horrified. No, that's suborning perjury. You can't do that. What do? You call up a doctor. You say, you get through a secretary's PhD. She said, I'm much easier to get a hold of. They just sit at their desks in academia. Doctors, you have to pass through their gatekeepers. But eventually, you get a guy on the phone. You say, I want to offer you a consulting gig. According to the number she gave me, it can be worth, in a good case, it can be worth tens of thousands of dollars, hundreds of dollars an hour, hundreds of hours. So you ask the doctor, in this scenario, this point in time, what would be your opinion about this? And if it's an opinion that you want to hear, you say, great, we'll offer you this rate if you'll come and testify for my client. So, power, she said, you're coming with a big law firm behind you, millions, billions of dollars in their war chest, kind of a fun thing to do. So halacha ultimately works on roughly the same system of expert witnesses. We don't actually typically pay tens of thousands of dollars. And the primary difference, though, is that while we do allow experts both brought by the parties themselves as well as experts that we seek out and we consult, our system is geared more toward experts that we pick. If we have a question, we will look for an expert. We do allow the parties to bring any experts that they want. We won't block them from doing that. They want to submit a report. Contractor wants to submit a report from some contractor he pays to assess his work. We'll let him do that. But the system typically, and at least in my experience, works more with experts that we consult. And this comes up a lot. A number of cases come to mind that I was involved in I remember once, as I said, we sometimes did fairly small cases. One particularly frustrating din Torah was between a woman and her Shetelmacher. The Shetelmacher had delivered a Shetel, which was produced by the customer, was Exhibit A on our table, pulled it out of an envelope. And she said, this was my order form. I described the Shetel thus. This was the product. This does not satisfy this description. The Shetelmacher said, yes, it does. So the order form had various boxes checked off, and the main issue revolved around the use of the word stringy. The customer had stipulated that the hair not be stringy, and the customer felt that it was. Shetelmacher insisted that with a natural human hair, whatever it was, I don't remember all the details, this is how it comes out. There's natural variance, and it's not, you know, rigid and stiff, and this is what it looks like. They were arguing back and forth, two women in front of us, for an hour whether this was a stringy shetel or not. So eventually we told them, we said, look, we encourage you to work something out. We encourage you to try it. Said, if not, we have not the faintest idea as to whether this shetel is considered stringy. What we will have to do is consult a shetelmacher. We'll may have to pay a nominal fee for a consultation. You know, any fees that we have in such cases, we distribute equally between both parties. And we'll have to ask for a formal report on whether this shetel is stringy or not. Eventually, I think they did settle. They agreed on some settlement. Once, I remember, there was a case of a guy who decided, his wife was away for a few days, he decided to surprise her with a brand new kitchen floor. This was a bad idea. He had the contractor put in a floor while she was away. When she came back, she did not like it. So he was looking for a way not to pay the contractors, so he claimed that the color, it was a subtle shade of the color was off. It did not match the samples he had been shown. So he brought in the samples to the Beis Din. Showed us what the sample was. The contractor kept saying, of course, it's not a perfect match. It's natural wood. There's variation in the grain or whatever. So this time, we felt that we were able to render an opinion of just simply a man on the street question. Would a normal person consider this a fair match or not? So we actually went down on our hands and knees on the floor looking to see if we thought this was a close enough match or not. We do actually sometimes do these things ourselves. We don't always hire experts. We sometimes will check ourselves. But on the whole, for anything, you know, we'd like to think that we understand when we're out of our depth, when we require expert opinion, and we will consult an expert. We consult realtors on questions involving real estate prices or real estate practices. My chief and I, we once had a case involving a threat of a disgruntled client to call in sanctions against a realtor. Neither party was very clear on what the effects of these sanctions would be, which we thought was an important detail to deciding what to do with the case. So we actually called up one of the real estate boards, presented ourselves as disgruntled clients, and tried to figure out what the sanctions process was, you know, what would happen, what would the result be. But in general, we consult experts. We do either our own due diligence or we consult people who we expect can help us with an opinion. When it comes to child custody, divorce cases, where the best interest of the child is a primary, if not the primary standard, social workers will be consulted, psychologists, and in any case where there are real issues about fitness of parents, you know, we're not necessarily going to make that decision on our own. And again, a judge also. You know, obviously, a judge with experience in these areas will be helpful, but judges are not typically, they don't have dual CID or whatever, and legal, they consult experts, and the parties bring experts, they consult, they appoint their own experts. And that's, roughly speaking, our system. There's a lot less money involved, and it's a lot less formal, but ultimately, that is the system which we work with also. Eventually, the Beis Din, after going through its procedures, deliberations, doesn't succeed in mediating or negotiating a settlement, Beis Din will hand down a verdict, typically in writing. We almost invariably issue verdicts in writing, occasionally oral. If for some reason they need an immediate verdict, we'll typically follow it up with a written verdict, but typically in writing. And this is a fairly touchy question involving whether the verdict will contain any detail or any reasoning. The policy of my organization was to avoid giving any detail or any reasoning in the final verdict. My understanding is, again, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding is the arbitration statutes don't actually require us to do so. We explicitly stipulate up front that the parties would have no right to expect anything more than a basic verdict without any reasoning or argumentation. And halacha, it's complicated. There are certain cases in which a Beis Din is obligated to provide a written and or a reasoned verdict. Certain cases they are not. The rules are tricky. In any event, we specifically have the litigants waive that in advance, and therefore, as a firm rule, we never issue reasoned verdicts. Our policy was, actually, that we would be prepared to explain a verdict, but only after compliance and after a suitable cooling down period has passed, because in our experience, in my chief's experience, requests for explanations were generally in preparation for contesting and fighting, and we were not interested. So we said first compliance, and then cool off, and then if you still are interested, if you really are interested, you'll come back to us. And my chief used to like to say that almost never happened. They were mostly just because people wanted to contest it. Occasionally they did. A couple of times, cases I was on, people contacted me, the chief contacted me, others did, and they said so-and-so actually wants to know why we did what we did. Let's reconstruct it. And then we would tell them, and we did in those cases. We explained how we arrived at the conclusion that we did. How are the verdicts or decisions enforced? So again, all Batei Din operate as arbitration panels. An arbitration agreement handed down by a mutually agreed upon arbitrator can be taken to court, and the court will generally enforce it, assuming that the other side can't deduce any significant procedural irregularity. And that's method number one. It can be taken to court and enforced. Method number two is moral suasion, communal pressure. Obviously, this depends on the community, depends on the person, depends on how self-destructive the person wants to be, and depends how aggressive the basin is willing to be. But we, in my experience, frequently invoked both of these methods against recalcitrant litigants. Sometimes it was convenient, we would simply allow the other litigant to take the case to court and let the court handle it. Sometimes we would issue a writ of contempt, essentially, against the other party. If the other party cared at all about being a member of the community in good standing, he would feel some pressure to cooperate. One last point, I guess, and then we'll call it an evening, is appeal. People are not satisfied with the Beis Din. Typically, that is the loser who is not satisfied with the verdict against him. He often wants to appeal. So we actually have a no appeal clause in our agreements. Under arbitration, again, we can pretty much do that. We don't have to give him any recourse for reconsideration. But they didn't have different policies. Beis Din of America, for example, has an internal appellate policy. They state this up front, that if you're dissatisfied with the verdict, you have the right to ask for a rehearing, I think, by the leaders of the Beis Din of America, or by Willick, perhaps. We have a much broader, much more flexible, I believe the Silver Spring Beis Din has a similar arrangement, that we tell you if you're not satisfied, contact us, and we leave it to our own discretion. At our discretion, we will reconsider, rehear, depending on whether we think you're actually bringing anything new to the table. We don't guarantee a rehearing, and we don't guarantee new members of the Beis Din rehearing it. We leave it pretty much up to our complete discretion. Of course, the court has the legal right, certainly, to consider what we do, whether they like it or not. But again, my understanding is, both what I've been told by lawyers as well as what I've read from experience, is that the court is fairly reluctant to overturn an arbitration agreement and will pretty much not do so unless you can convince them of some gross unfairness, procedural or maybe substantial, although that's, again, pretty rare. In Israel, the Rabbanut system does have a hierarchical system of appeals. In Israel, there are many ways in which the basin system is much more westernized, much more like a court. They do issue elaborate written reasoned decisions. The Piskei Din, Shel Batei HaDin HaRabbaniim BYisrael, the collected case verdicts of some of the higher courts in Israel, is one of the most valuable, one of the most wonderful resources for the working dayan today. It's about some 20, 25 volumes now, about 6,000 pages of verdict handed down by some of the stellar names of halachic jurisprudence in Eretz Yisrael, everyone from Rav Yashar Zichrono Levracha, Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Adya Hadaya, Rav Yosef Kapach, Rav Tzal Zolti, and a lot of less famous people. So that's a monumental 6,000-7,000 pages of verdicts. That's very useful. And they also have an appellate system. And this was actually a great controversy back around the 1920s under a mandatory Palestine. The British, in order to give them autonomy, wanted certain westernizations to the Beis Din system. One of them was an appellate system. So the Gedolei HaRabbanim of the time had a great debate about it. And the consensus was, though, as reflected in rulings by more later poskim like Rav Avadia Yosef, Rav Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Uziel, that even if, and there's a whole separate discussion, what Beis Din has to say about whether the halachic system typically has room for appeal or not. Rabbi Bleich has a classic article on it. I've written about it based on his and other works. But The consensus of later poskim is that regardless of whether native halacha has an appellate process, a community has the right to establish whatever rules and procedures they want. And since in Israel the community has decided through the democratic process that that's the way they want the system to be, that is absolutely valid under halacha, and that is indeed the custom in Israel today. And I guess we will stop here.